Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Massacre in Buffalo. Local residents grapple with grief and trauma after the mass shooting that police say was motivated by racism.
Our community is devastated. As much as we try not to struggle with the spirit of fear, people are scared.
Then, expanding NATO. The ambassadors of Finland and Sweden discussed the future of security in Europe and Russia's warnings following their request to join the alliance. And COVID year three, as the number of deaths from the virus hit 1 million in the U.S., a highly transmissible subvariant threatens to prolong the pandemic even further. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Federal authorities are investigating the weekend massacre in Buffalo as a potential hate crime. Law enforcement officials also reported today that the accused gunman had planned to continue his shooting spree at another location if he had escaped. That news came as communities in Buffalo mourned the losses from an attack that claimed 10 lives. All were black. Special correspondent Kat Wise has our report.
Today, as the community of Buffalo, New York, learned more about a gunman's racist shooting rampage at a supermarket over the weekend, the reality was setting in. Eddie Colbert has lived in the area for 50 years. He's suddenly fearful of his usual routines and visits to local stores.
I was thinking about the fact that it could be me or anybody else going in or coming out of that store, you know. So this is something that's going to be scary for anybody now. You know, because we don't know if there's any other haters that's out there that's going to copy this, you know.
Tops Market sees heavy foot traffic from residents nearby as one of the only grocery stores in the predominantly black neighborhood. Keshanti Atkinson was working as a cashier when the gunman entered. She hid in a conference room and is still reeling from the experience.
During the incident, I was scared because I didn't know if he was gonna find us and just shoot us, and I didn't know nothing. But now, I mean, I'm still a little bit scared because this was supposed to be a safe environment.
The attack happened on Saturday here at the Top Supermarket on Buffalo's east side. The alleged gunman drove about 200 miles from his hometown to the parking lot behind me, armed with an assault rifle. Today, law enfororsement officials remained at the scene, poring over the evidence.
The 18-year-old gunman live-streamed the shooting from a helmet camera to a small audience on the platform Twitch. He shot 13 people, killing 10 of them. Of his victims, 11 were black. The Buffalo Police Commissioner made clear he was targeting them.
The evidence that we have uncovered so far makes no mistake that this is an absolute racist hate crime.
Peyton Gendron, who ultimately surrendered to police after pointing a weapon to his neck, pleaded not guilty at his arraignment. Grimalia told CNN today the gunman had planned to continue his rampage, possibly at another supermarket. The Buffalo massacre is reminiscent of other racist attacks, including a 2015 mass shooting at a black church in Charleston and another in 2019 at a Walmart in a predominantly Hispanic area of El Paso, Texas. And it's left families like Ruth Whitfield's in agonizing grief. Whitfield, one of the victims, was shopping after visiting her husband in a nursing home. Going to Tops was a daily ritual for her. She was 86 years old.
We had no answers. What do we tell our father? We don't even know. He doesn't know. What do we tell him? How do we tell him the love of his life, his primary caretaker?
Another victim, Kat Massey, was an advocate for civil rights and education. She wrote to local news outlets last year calling for federal regulation of firearms. She was 72 years old. Reverend Denise Walden Glenn has been providing comfort to her community. She works for Voices Buffalo, an interfaith racial justice and equity organization.
Our community is hurting. Our community is devastated. As much as we try not to struggle with the spirit of fear, people are scared. People are scared. People are scared to leave their homes. People are scared to go into public spaces. Children are afraid to return to school. They're afraid for their parents to go to work or their caregivers to go to work. People are afraid.
Officials say the gunman subscribed to a racist ideology known as the Great Replacement Theory that's made its way from the fringes of the internet into mainstream discourse on the right. It's a belief in the false theory that there's a plot by non-white people to replace the power and influence of white people. Civil rights attorney Ben Crump blames the gunman and those who influenced him to commit the act.
All these people who are talking about this race replacement theory, radicalizing these young, impressionable minds to go out and do irrational acts because they know they have an irrational audience.
Police were called to his high school last June after he made threatening remarks. But after a brief mental health evaluation, he was free to go. The impacts of that release are now reverberating throughout this city and the country.
This is our mother. This is our lives. We need help. We're asking you to help us. Help us change this. This can't keep happening.
The president and first lady will make a trip to Buffalo tomorrow to meet with families and see the grieving community firsthand. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Kat Wise in Buffalo, New York.
This attack, like too many before it, is leading to a renewed conversation and for some self-examination for many on questions of race, white supremacy, and extremist ideology. We're going to focus on some of those questions ourselves with Eric Ward. He has long studied all of this and the proliferation of hate crimes. He's now at the Southern Poverty Law Center. And Jelani Cobb, writer, journalist, and historian. He's also the next dean of the Columbia Journalism School. Our conversation is part of our ongoing coverage of race matters. Jelani Cobb, Eric Ward, welcome to you both. Jelani Cobb, let me start with you. We heard that man at the very beginning of Kat Wise's piece say, "We don't know if there are any other haters out there." What is your answer to him?
Well, we can answer that in the affirmative. I don't think, unfortunately, there's any question. When we look at the connections between, you know, what happened in Charleston, South Carolina in 2015, you know, what happened in El Paso, you know, what happened at the Tree of Life in Pittsburgh, what's happened now in Buffalo, what's happened in other places that I'm not mentioning now, you know, having covered and having written about this issue, we can be fairly certain that there are more people of a like mind who are out there. And, you know, the bigger question is what we are as a society are prepared to do in order to prevent these kinds of atrocities from happening again and again.
I want to ask you, Eric Ward, because you have spent decades looking at this issue. Is this incident that we see in Buffalo just another incident of anti-black hate? Is there something that stands out to you about this particular moment?
Yes, it is a moment where we are beginning to watch the unfolding of mission-oriented hate crimes. These are not merely reactionary hate crimes that we have witnessed of the old, the targeting of minority communities. This is an ideology that is fueling this violence. This violence is not an aberration of the Great Replacement Theory. It is a feature, and it is a feature that is grounded in anti-Semitism. Let's be clear. This killer believed that by targeting and killing African Americans, that he was engaging in a war against what he believed to be a Jewish conspiracy. And so we're beginning to understand that this underlying Jewish conspiracy called the Great Replacement Theory is threatening not just Jews, but all of us. But what's most frightening is that elected officials are beginning to mainstream and promote this message in the halls of Congress.
And Jelani Cobb, I mean, which leads us to the question, why does it keep happening? The incidents that you named and so many more in this country, what is it that has gotten into the psyche of Americans that these terrible things keep happening?
I mean, I think this is a much bigger, conversation that we see. You know, mass violence happening across an array of factors. But most fundamentally, we don't do anything after it happens. We don't enact meaningful legislation. We don't have any significant changes in policy. we make dramatic public displays of grief, at least our elected officials do, and then effectively go back to what they were doing before. And I've covered so many of these stories that I really hate to sound cynical, but there is a particular script that we can expect things to follow in the trajectory of them over the next days and weeks. We'll mourn, we'll grieve, and eventually we'll recede back into the same sorts of habitual behaviors that facilitated this in the first place.
Eric Ward, do you think we are going to fall back into that same pattern this time?
Regretfully, we will, as long as we continue to tolerate the rhetoric that creates this theory that Jews are somehow secretly trying to take over the world. We have to push back against this anti-Semitism. But we have to make real our opposition to this white nationalist terror that is taking place around the country. We need government to step in. We need business leaders to step up. And we need community organizations to be trained and prepared to how to deal and manage with political violence. This is not ending. This is not an aberration. This is a beginning of the targeting of minorities in order to overthrow American democracy. We have to be serious in this.
Jelani Cobb, what more specifically do you think needs to be done to get people's attention? You're right. We talk about these incidents. We cover them in the news media for a period of time. But then, as you just point out, they happen again and again. What different needs to happen?
Well, one of the things I think that's really important in this is that if we want to talk about what's different between now, because there's a long tradition of white nationalist terrorism and white nationalist violence in this country, if we want to talk about the differentiating factor of the current moment, one is the access to this information on the internet and on social media. And we have to come up with some sort of meaningful reform. And of course, in some instances, it seems that, you know, the social media is going in the opposite direction of responsibility. But we have to come up with some sort of mechanisms, whether that be through, kind of private acts or pressure from private groups or some combination of government relationships and oversight. But the fact is that it's indisputable at this point. We have data that points to people being radicalized and indoctrinated, via social media. And that's one avenue that people can take meaningful steps to address, at least as a beginning to do something.
You're speaking about the responsibility that these big tech companies have, essentially.
Sure, certainly.
And the lack of regulation. Eric Ward, is that something that realistically can happen? I mean, because I keep coming back to hearts and minds. Do we think it's a matter of changing what's racist in people's hearts? Is it a matter of stopping that racism from becoming these terrible acts of violence? Where do you see the stopping that needs to happen?
I think there's three things we could do immediately, Judy, that begin to send a message that we are serious about responding to white nationalist violence and its threat. The first is we can be responsive to the community of Buffalo, particularly the families and friends of those who are survivors of friends that they have and families that they have lost. That is a community where we can make race equity real and a model for the nation, and we should take on that challenge. The second, though, is that local communities need relief from federal government. Many local communities and counties have been struggling under the weight of white nationalist violence, and they need help. They need resources to be able to respond. The third is this: we have to have the public will. And the truth is this: if we were able to revamp the world economy in 3 weeks to come to the support of Ukraine by the invasion of Russia, we can build the political will here if we choose to be responsive to this white nationalist assault on America.
Jelani Cobb, do you think that political will is there? And I have to ask you both, let me ask you that first. Is the political will there?
Certainly not on the right in this country. We have seen what were once fringe politics become more and more parts of the mainstream and the Republican Party, at least in terms of the rhetoric that we've seen among conservatives. And so that is something that, you know, people will have to speak out more forcefully about. We'll have to address. That just doesn't seem to be high, you know, on the list of priorities, or address in meaningful ways. And that doesn't seem to be happening. I think at some point it's possible that these sorts of actions will become so volatile and so dangerous that it will create a pressure for people to distance themselves. But at this point, honestly, we've seen so much of this violence. I don't understand. I can't predict the scale of the catastrophe that would be required to make people begin to think twice or to think about this differently.
A very quick final question to you both. We heard people in Buffalo expressing outright fear after this. What would you say to them in this moment? Jelani Cobb.
I think that it is right to be concerned, but I think that the object of these sorts of behaviors is to instill fear in people, and that the only way to proceed is to recognize, to be vigilant, to be aware of your surroundings, but not to succumb to fear, because fear is the ultimate objective.
And Eric Ward.
Judy, this is our opportunity to show the community of Buffalo that they are not alone. Not today, not this week, or for the years to come. This is an opportunity to speak directly to the white nationalist movement by investing the best opportunities and energy, right, to ally ourselves with those who have faced horror in Buffalo, New York.
Eric Ward, Jelani Cobb, we thank you.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, police in Southern California say a Chinese immigrant acted out of hate for Taiwan in a Sunday shooting at a church. One person was killed and five wounded. The gunman opened fire at a luncheon for a Taiwanese immigrant congregation and was then overpowered. The local sheriff said today the man had lived in Taiwan before coming to the U.S.
Based on preliminary information in the investigation, it is believed the suspect involved was upset about political tensions between China and Taiwan.
The suspect, 68-year-old David Cho of Las Vegas, is charged with murder and attempted murder. A former neighbor said today that Cho was never the same after he was nearly beaten to death several years ago. There has been movement today on the baby formula shortage. Abbott Laboratories has announced a consent decree with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to reopen a formula plant in Michigan. It is the nation's largest, but it has been closed since February due to contamination. In Ukraine, the ravaged city of Mariupol appears on the verge of falling to Russian forces. Wounded fighters were evacuated today from a steel complex, and Ukraine's military said it's trying to rescue the last holdouts. Also today, Sweden joined Finland in announcing that it will apply to join NATO, and Russia's President Vladimir Putin offered a somewhat toned-down response. Putin spoke at a summit in Moscow. In a reversal, he suggested Russia could live with NATO accepting Sweden and Finland if it does not go too far.
As far as NATO's expansion, new members Finland and Sweden included, Russia has no problem with those states. Therefore, the addition of those countries poses no direct threat for us. But the expansion of military infrastructure into this territory will obviously call for our response.
Both Sweden and Finland have ruled out accepting NATO troops or hardware on their territory. We'll return to this after the news summary. McDonald's has announced that it is leaving Russia after more than 30 years of doing business there. The company says it is selling most of its 850 Russian restaurants. It will continue paying some 62,000 employees until the sale closes. President Biden is redeploying U.S. troops to Somalia. He signed the order today amid concerns about al-Shabaab rebels who have links to al-Qaeda. Then President Trump had withdrawn nearly all of the 700 U.S. Special Operations Forces who were stationed in Somalia. The CDC today confirmed 1 million COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. to date. That is more American deaths in the Civil War and World War II combined. And with infections rising in New York City, health officials urge people to mask up again in indoor public settings. Meanwhile, North Korea reported 56 deaths and some 1.5 million infections from what they call an unspecified fever. Leader Kim Jong-un visited pharmacies in Pyongyang and criticized the slow pace of COVID medicine deliveries. He also mobilized North Korea's army to help. The U.S. Supreme Court has sided with Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz over letting political candidates lend money to their own campaigns and then get repaid. A 2002 law capped how much campaign money can be used for that purpose, but Cruz challenged the provision. By 6-3 today, the court ruled that the restriction violates freedom of expression. A Los Angeles judge today struck down California's law requiring that there be women on corporate boards. The 2018 statute required publicly held companies based in California to have up to 3 women on their boards. The judge ruled that it violated the state constitution by mandating a gender-based quota. And on Wall Street, stocks started higher but ended mostly lower, led by tech shares again. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 26 points to close at 32,223. But the NASDAQ fell 142 points, that's 1%, and the S&P 500 gave up 16. Still to come on the NewsHour, why the fight against COVID appears to have stalled in the U.S. Tamara Keith and Amy Walter break down the latest political headlines. Young playwrights use the theater to confront the ongoing trauma of gun violence, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As we've reported, Sweden's Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson today announced that her country would join NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, ending more than 200 years of military non-alignment. The announcement follows a similar one this weekend from neighboring Finland. Nick Schifrin has more.
It is a historic generational shift by the governments of Sweden and Finland and their populations. After the Cold War ended, Sweden and Finland joined the European Union but refused to join NATO, pursuing instead a policy of armed neutrality. Finland shares an 830-mile border with Russia, and as recently as February, the government said it had no plans to join NATO. But the invasion of Ukraine has changed everything. In 2017, 22% of Finns and 32% of Swedes supported joining NATO. Today, those numbers are 76% in Finland and 53% in Sweden. For more on this, we turn to Sweden's ambassador to the United States, Karin Olofsdotter, and Finland's ambassador to the United States, Mikko Hautala. Welcome, both of you, to the NewsHour. Let me start with you, Ambassador Olofsdotter. Why are you applying for NATO today?
Well, we have seen a dramatic shift in our region. When Russia attacked the Ukraine in February, that was a dramatic shift. A neighboring country of ours attacking an, you know, unprovoked country, democracy, another European state. That really changed everything for us.
Ambassador Hautala, you train and share intelligence with NATO. Your membership in the EU includes a treaty to assist any member country that is attacked. So why is that no longer good enough?
I think we have now a clear plan to execute our longstanding foreign policy position, which is that we have already said for almost 2 decades that in case situation changes, we may apply for NATO membership. That's what we are doing right now. Of course, we also think that the EU common solidarity between the member states continues to be important and relevant, but we think that NATO as a defensive alliance is definitely needed in this kind of a situation with its own military capabilities.
Ambassador Olofsdotter, you need all 30 countries in NATO to agree. And today, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called Sweden a, quote, incubation center for the PKK, the Kurdish group that's deemed a terrorist group by the EU and the U.S. Will you extradite the Kurds living in Sweden that Turkey is currently asking for?
That is something we have not discussed. We are, you know, seeking contact with Turkey to discuss all the issues we have in front of us, and we look very much forward to cooperating with Turkey as an ally in NATO. So we are trying to have discussions with the Turks and look forward to that.
Ambassador Hautala, I know that Finland has said it was blindsided by Turkey's announcement. Do you believe Turkey has a price that NATO can pay?
Well, that remains to be seen. We have received some inconsistent messages from Turkey. First from President Erdogan saying that they would support the application. Now we are hearing something else. I think we have to find out also together with Sweden what we are talking about and what that does that mean. But I think we have a really good relationship with Turkey, and I believe that we can sort of have a good discussion on those items and then find a solution.
Ambassador Ulaftadar, Vladimir Putin made comments today that some people found interesting. He changed his rhetoric and said he had, quote, no problems with Sweden or Finland joining NATO, but that creating new NATO infrastructure would, quote, trigger a response. So do you believe that's a real threat? And do you have any plans to expand NATO infrastructure in Sweden? Ambassador Ulaftadar?
Yes. No, I mean, we are joining NATO as a full member, of course, with everything that that implies. So that is discussions that we will have with NATO as we go forward in our accession process. Of course, we are happy that the Russians don't see it as a threat that we are joining NATO. We have heard differently before, and given the unpredictability and what we have seen in the Ukraine, we, of course, have to take every precaution we can to strengthen our own security. So we have decided to, you know, go up to 2% of our on our defense budget. We are ramping up our missile defense, our air force, our marine, navy, and building submarines, etc. So we are really taking our security very seriously. But of course, that was a quite good message coming out of the Kremlin today.
Ambassador Hautala, you're the former ambassador in Moscow. Were you surprised by Putin's language today?
Not really. I think it's basically consistent with what he has said before many years ago. But of course, given the dramatic shift in February in Ukraine, I think we had to take seriously also all kinds of scenarios that might take place. And we continue certainly to do so. So we take all the precautions. But of course, this message is welcome. And I think that it's, as I said, it's consistent with what they have said before.
Ambassador Ulaftadar, there will be a time between Sweden's requesting to join NATO and actually being inside of NATO. And today, the prime minister said that that would be a, quote, vulnerable position. The United Kingdom has publicly said that it has a mutual security agreement during that time. But do you feel that you have enough security guarantees from the U.S. or other NATO countries during that gap?
Of course, we are fully aware of we can't get full security guarantees until we are a full member of the alliance. But our friends, the Norwegians and the Danes and the Germans and the Brits and others have, you know, stated that they are willing to do whatever it takes to help us keeping us safe in this period. We are, of course, taking our own security very seriously. So, you know, we have ramped up the threshold for any aggression. So together with our friends and allies and partners, we think that we can, you know, make it tougher to threaten us in the meantime. So that's a discussion we are having now on the details of that in the period coming up. But we are very happy for the support we get from everyone in our vicinity on helping us during this time.
Ambassador Hautala, I want to move the conversation over to Ukraine. You're the former ambassador to Moscow and to Kyiv. Ukrainian officials I spoke to just a couple days ago when I was in Kyiv used the word victory. Do you fear, though, that Russia would escalate before it's seen to lose?
I think certainly it's a possibility that we have to take into account. I do believe that we have a long conflict in our hands. And I think the Russians are not yet certainly ready to give up on anything. And I think they have their old war goals still in their minds. So I think it's very hard to predict what's going to happen next. But obviously, there's not going to be a fast solution to this war.
Ambassador Ulaftadar, I noticed on Friday that Ukraine's top aide, Andriy Yermak, said that while he was happy for both Finland and Sweden to join NATO, it was, quote, a double standard of NATO to fast track your admission. Why should Ukraine wait now for 14 years and not get into NATO when your countries are expected to join NATO within months?
Well, that's, of course, a question for the alliance to take.
Ambassador Ulaftadar, sorry.
I think it's the same, that it's the alliance has set certain standards, and I think it's up to the alliance to decide which countries meet those standards and how fast and to which with which result they should proceed. So we are trying to do our best. We are together with Sweden, long-standing democracies, also countries with very basically non-existent corruption and with heavy defense spending in our case. So I think it's up to the alliance to decide how do we meet the criteria.
Ambassador Ulefdatter, I just have about 45 seconds left, so I'll direct this last question to you. The U.S. has a pro-NATO president today, but President Trump was questioned NATO while he was president, and of course the next president could question NATO. So do you believe that you have in the U.S. a reliable partner inside NATO in the future?
Yes, I do. We've been a long-standing partner and have had a great partnership for many, many years. So I think the alliance will persist. And there are many members in the NATO alliance, 30 of them, not only the United States, but of course the United States is one of the most important ones. But I trust that the United States will stay in NATO.
Ambassador Karin Ulefdatter, Ambassador Mikko Hautala, thank you very much to you both.
Thanks. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
We knew the day was coming, and now it's arrived. The United States has now recorded more than 1 million COVID deaths. It is the highest reported death toll of any country. And this terrible, largely preventable milestone comes as cases are once again on the rise. William Brangham has more.
Judy, the country is mourning these deaths right as new, even more highly transmissible Omicron variants emerge. As a result, cases in the U.S. have climbed 60% in 2 weeks, and hospitalizations are up 24%. For a deeper look at all of this and where this is heading, I'm joined again by Dr. Eric Topol. He's the founder and director of the Scripps Research Translational Institute. Dr. Topol, great to have you back on the NewsHour. So the country is trying to find a way to reckon with this 1 million deaths, and yet these new variants are showing up. It's clearly that this virus is not done with us yet. When you look out at the pandemic today, what is it that most concerns you?
Well, Bill, good to be with you. The problem we have is this illusion or deception that the pandemic is over, when in fact these variants that we're seeing are coming at a much faster clip. There's an accelerated evolution of the virus, and these are more troubling variants. They're not more mild. In fact, they have a more immune escape. So they're transmitting at levels that is really inconceivable and starting to approach the level of measles, one of the most spreadable pathogens we've ever encountered. So we have trouble right now. As you mentioned, we are seeing at least 600,000-700,000 real cases a day. Likely it's going to continue to increase in this country as we confront this so-called BA.2.1.2.1 variant, one of the several of the Omicron family.
You mentioned immune escape, and for people who are not familiar with this, you're talking about the ability of these newly mutated, newly evolving strains to punch past our protections, to evade our vaccination. Is that right?
Exactly. So, William, this is basically our immune system doesn't see them, doesn't see the virus as it saw previous versions of the virus, because there's so much distance, or the protein is basically looks different to our body. So it fakes us out. And that's why people who had Omicron, which is about 40 to 50% of Americans back in January and February, that BA.1 variant, the new one that's now rising to levels of dominance in this country, already in the New England region, but also, of course, will be throughout the country, we can have reinfections because they're so different. That is, we don't see those who've been infected with the BA.1 don't see this new problematic version of in the Omicron family.
I mean, one of the things we've always been consoled with, which is if you've been vaccinated and boosted, and even if you got a BA.1, an original Omicron infection, you were very protected. You might have a breakthrough infection, but you were not going to end up in the hospital, and you were certainly not going to end up dying. Do those new strains, these new strains, change that calculus?
Yeah, so we've counted on our vaccines to give us this 90-95% protection from severe disease, hospitalizations, and deaths. But that's slipping now. And we're in a denial state that it's now down to 85-80%. That's actually a big drop, because the gap is, instead of 5%, we're talking about fourfold more people who might go on and get severe disease, even being vaccinated with one or two boosters. This is what is a real problem that we're not confronting right now.
Help me understand something here, because there seems to be a real disconnect. All of the things that you're reporting would be alarming to most people who have been paying attention to this epidemic. Now, but you look at the CDC's map, it shows the country where, well, there's a few hot spots, the orange up in New York and some yellow up in Minnesota and Michigan, but the rest of the country looks green, as if there isn't a problem with this virus. What is the disconnect there?
Well, I've called it a capitulation. That is, the CDC is, frankly, it's a deception that the level of the virus is low when the transmission is incredibly high. I mean, it's starting to approach that of what we saw with the Omicron wave, and it's rising quickly. So this is really irresponsible of the CDC to give us this impression that things are copacetic when they couldn't be further from the truth, William.
Let's just say that this continues to worsen, and public officials start to say we need to reintroduce precautions, as we saw in New York City today, recommending masks indoors again. Do you think, broadly speaking, that the country will listen? I mean, everywhere I travel in the country, it seems like people are done with this. They don't want to think about it anymore. They are ready for this to be in the rearview mirror. If public health officials say it's time to tighten down precautions again, will people listen?
Well, that's a problem. I think it's very hard to go backwards. I mean, our thinking is going backwards, but our actions, we're not doing the things that we could do. You know, the innovations that we need to get ahead of the virus. I mean, the things, not just the mask and the physical distancing sort of thing that you're alluding to, but, you know, the things like having nasal vaccines and a pan beta coronavirus vaccine and much better medications beyond what we have today. Those things are imperative. And part of this capitulation is that we have basically a hand waving, oh, we're done. We don't want to put any further investments or funds or support. And this is a crucial time right now, because it's not going to get better. In fact, it's at a very serious state right now, and we have too many paths for trouble in the times ahead as well.
And as we've seen, certainly Congress is deadlocked on this whole issue of COVID funding. Dr. Eric Topol from Scripps Research, always good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you. I wish I had a brighter message to convey. Thank you.
Days after the massacre in Buffalo, the response from political leaders has turned not to the usual conversation on guns, but to the power of the racist ideology that fuels attacks like this one. Lisa Desjardins is here with more.
Judy, for the political response to this tragedy, as well as a look ahead to some critical primary races tomorrow, I'm joined by our always thoughtful Political Monday team. That is Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR. Politics Monday is here. Let's start off with this another unspeakable shooting, and some people here in Washington especially are looking at the words of some Republicans, including this from Elise Stefanik, the representative who is in House Republican leadership. This is a Facebook ad she posted last year, a campaign ad. It warns of a, quote, permanent election insurrection and defines that as the arrival of undocumented immigrants. Now, Stefanik has disavowed the Buffalo shooting. She represents a district in New York. But some do see that ad as a reference to this, what we hear about, the white replacement theory, which the suspect in the Buffalo shooting wrote about. Amy, I'm going to start with you. What do you think is going on underneath here? Why are some Republicans feeding or maybe not actively trying to address white anger?
I think, as this piece, as the lead-in alluded to, you know, lots of times when these things happen, these horrible tragedies involving guns, we talk about the Second Amendment. In this case, we're focusing on the First Amendment. And so the issue really about, well, what is free speech exactly? It's been with us for a very long time. What you can and cannot say, what's inciting violence, what is simply okay to be able to talk about. And that is a debate that we've been having most recently about what gets posted on the internet, right? And whose responsibility is that? But it's also in the political dialogue as well, which is we know that the rhetoric just keeps getting ramped up and ramped up and ramped up. And this idea that there are, you know, this is just a political, that it won't seep into the broader society is not true, right? The more that leaders, people who are in leadership positions, are willing to either excuse it or find ways to sort of switch the topic, the harder it becomes for leaders to stand up and say, actually, we can draw a line. There is a First Amendment, but this, just not acceptable. And we need to hold ourselves, even if internet companies or the broader world won't hold us to those standards, we need to do it.
And speaking of leaders, there was a tweet from another Republican, former member of leadership, Liz Cheney, who tweeted, the GOP leadership has enabled white nationalism, white supremacy, and anti-Semitism. Tam, these are kinds of ideas, white replacement theory, that used to be way on the fringe. How are they now in the political mainstream for some people?
So white replacement theory was KKK neo-Nazi stuff. And then it started seeping in theory, more palatable form, right? Instead of white replacement theory, it's political replacement theory. That ad from Elise Stefanik was the idea that Democrats or somebody wants to bring in lots of illegal immigrants who could then become legal and become American citizens and vote and replace Native American or, you know, Native-born American voters. That's the theory behind this.
You, conservative voter.
Conservative voters. That there would be a liberal majority. that is how it went from the fringes to the main, sort of the Republican mainstream. And you had in Charlottesville those people marching, chanting with tiki torches, saying, Jews will not replace us, you will not replace us. That was replacement theory in a way that was unpalatable. But in the years...
But at least it was clear. It was clear what they were saying.
Yes, and in the years since then, it has become something that is discussed in politics as like, this is something that is going to happen and that somebody wants this to happen. And it is not in the exact same terms as white replacement theory, and that is what Stefanik's spokesperson pushed back on. She doesn't have racist ideas. She's simply saying that there shouldn't be amnesty. It all mixes and melds together.
Right, and that's the whole thing about what is free speech and what is hateful rhetoric that incites people to do terrible things.
And then what is there to do? New White House press secretary on her first day on the job, Karine Jean-Pierre, was asked today if the White House should push back more, call out people by name like Tucker Carlson. We talked about him on this show last night. And we play a role too, right, in the media? So my question for you guys is, do voters hear these ideas challenged enough? And if not, who and where, how does that happen, Amy?
Well, as you know, Lisa, the part of the problem is we have media bubbles. Yeah. There is not cross-pollination. And so there are people who are paying very close attention to this and are very outraged. And then there are other folks who probably aren't gonna hear much about this at all.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right, what
Amy said. Yeah, we are in bubbles. The American population is vulnerable to receiving conspiracy theories and accepting them as reality. And, you know, there is no defined truth. And that sort of social isolation allows people to go into the dark recesses of the internet and find things that confirm their beliefs and lead to really dangerous places.
But it's obviously front of mind, especially for those of us here in the media. How do we get that truth out there? What do we do? But another topic that does overlap with these sharp divides, primaries. We have some tomorrow, some good ones. North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and others. I just got back from the Keystone State. Fantastic few days there. Republicans in the Senate race have three very conservative candidates, including this sort of new surging Kathy Barnett. Democrats have an unconventional Senate candidate as well, John Fetterman, the lieutenant governor. I want to ask you, Tam, is the idea of who can win changing? There used to be a formula. These aren't formulaic candidates.
Right. It's someone like a Dave McCormick, who's one of the Republican candidates. He's a veteran. He had success in business. If you went back 10 years to Republican candidate central casting, you would find him. But then Trump got elected, and the idea of what is electable, I think, has changed somewhat. Mm-hmm. Someone like John Fetterman is not traditionally considered even remotely electable. He doesn't care. He shows up in, there you go, in a hoodie and gym shorts for a meeting with the President of the United States. And yet he is, you know, appealing to rural voters. He's appealing to working class voters that Democrats have been struggling with. So and someone like Barnett grabs attention, makes people have passion. And I don't know if they're going to win their primaries. I'm not here to make predictions. But I think that they are an example of candidates who are potentially redefining what it means.
Except we kind of flipped the script, Lisa. In 2018 and 2020, the one thing that unified Democrats was getting rid of Donald Trump. Yeah. And that meant electing in primaries the most electable candidate, which usually meant the most moderate to centrist.
Center, right, yeah.
On the Democratic side here, you have John Fetterman, who not only doesn't look the part with the sweatshirt and the shorts, but he comes from the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, which, again, in the 2018-2020 version of Democrats, they would say, whoa, maybe that's a little too dangerous in a state as conservative as Pennsylvania, and we should elect the more moderate. In this case, though, what Democrats are looking for is somebody who's going to be a fighter because they're frustrated that they're not seeing that from the party right now, and Fetterman's giving that.
All right. Amy Walter, Tamara Keith, great discussion. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
This weekend's mass shooting in Buffalo once again highlighted the devastating impact of gun violence in this country. It is a problem all too familiar to many Americans, and specifically young people. In 2020, guns became the leading cause of death for children, surpassing fatalities from car accidents. Activists across the country are working to shed light on this issue through a series of plays written and performed by young adults, many of whom have had direct experience with gun violence. Jeffrey Brown has the story for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
You know, I usually would let you go, but it was a shooting down there. Well, I know y'all be hanging, and I just don't want nothing to happen to you, JJ.
At New York City's Lincoln Center, the reading of a play about a woman who lost her husband to gun violence and now fears the worst for her son. It was written by 18-year-old Taylor Lafayette.
I really hope that my play, amongst others that were written, bring that change forth, that this cannot keep happening.
You got 3 seconds, then I'm taking it out your pockets.
I ain't got enough.
Three.
All right, chill, look, the money ain't with
me. Two.
In Tempe, Arizona, a performance about a boy who witnesses his older brother's murder and weighs whether to take revenge. One of the student actors, Byron Roberson Jr.
It's a part of life that you never want to face, but it's also one that you can't act as if it's not there. Ignorance isn't bliss when you're talking about this subject. Information, knowledge, that's the power.
The performances were part of Hashtag Enough, Plays to End Gun Violence, a project written and acted by young people, expressing their anger, frustration, and fear. Earlier this spring, on April 20th, the anniversary of the 1999 Columbine, Colorado school shooting, 8 plays were performed in 29 states across the country, including Pittsburgh.
Please walk by faith, please.
And Suitland, Maryland.
God, please don't kill us. It's not me. I don't have a choice.
Scenes evoked the aftermath of a mass shooting.
Another gun, another shooting.
It shouldn't have happened.
The trauma that endures when a loved one is lost.
But Mom cries every day now, staring at the spot in the street where her baby boy's body lay.
When I started this project, I told
Hashtag Enough is the brainchild of Michael Cody, a director and producer based in Chicago. In 2018, he was in a professional theater rehearsal when the Parkland, Florida shooting left 17 dead.
It just took over the entire vibe of the rehearsal. And then my memory of it is that 10 minutes later, we got back to working on plays. And that really left an unsettling feeling for me.
What was the feeling?
Frustrated that these things kept happening or feel like they keep happening. And like, what am I doing in the theater? Or like, more specifically, like, what could we be doing with the theater to address this directly?
His idea, let young people be the storytellers.
They're able to put a story behind these awful, enormous numbers that should just drive us insane to do something about it, but somehow don't. And I think that's what theater provides, this cathartic sense of where some people can go to express their grief and their anger and their trauma, but do that within their community.
A space that small, a weapon like that, it doesn't take more than a few minutes. We rehearse it maybe 20 times a Friday.
In 18-year-old Willa Colliery's play Rehearsal, a group of students and a teacher become obsessed with rehearsing a school shooting simulation.
It's had such an effect on, you know, the psyche of people like me, American teenagers, anyone who has to go to school. And it's very rare that you get the opportunity to write about something that is so important on such a, like, national, if not global scale.
Like many teens, Colliery, who lives in Los Angeles, has grown up in an America where school shooting drills are part of everyday life.
I go to school and all these very normal, sort of banal things are happening. I'm doing schoolwork, I'm thinking about lunch, and then on, like, beneath that, there's this weird undercurrent of anxiety about gun violence and, you know, looking around a room, where would I hide? Or there's like a door that slams really hard somewhere, and you know immediately that it's not, you know, what you think it is, but I think there's always this feeling of worry around it.
In Tempe, Arizona, Byron Roberson acted in a presentation of Colliery's play and found the experience cathartic.
A creative workspace is the best workspace, in my opinion, and when you're around people that make difficult things easy to talk about, it definitely helps a lot.
A freshman at Arizona State University, Roberson has lost both family and friends to gun violence.
I feel that the underlining thing is to understand and acknowledge what people do and to have that conversation about people. And this is one of those ways to have that conversation.
It's a conversation all too familiar for Arizona State Representative Jennifer Longden, who was shot and paralyzed 18 years ago. She was in the audience in Arizona and joined a post-performance discussion.
I found it really very intense, very true to life. I found myself holding my breath several points along the way. I think that it provides an outlet for the creators and the performers, and I think it's educational to the audience.
For her part, Taylor Lafayette traveled to New York from her home in Benoit, Mississippi. She's been writing since childhood, she told us, but this play was her most personal, a way to cope after losing her younger brother to gun violence.
He was 16, so very young, not even getting a chance to graduate high school, see senior year. And the fact that I do, I like to use that as motivation to keep going, actually.
Why does art become the way to help you do that?
Enough definitely drove me to see that I can use my voice as something more than just a way to release my own emotions. I can use it to cause change. I don't want to keep my writing to myself. I want it to be in the world because I feel that's where it needs to be.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
Enough! Enough!
A moment of uplift that we needed tonight. Thank you, Jeffrey Brown. And some late-breaking news, the Biden administration is reversing some Trump-era policies regarding Cuba and the expansion of travel to the island nation. It's permitting flights to cities other than Havana and allowing group travel for educational or professional purposes. It's also reestablishing a family reunification program and eliminating caps on how much money immigrants in the U.S. can send back to their families in Cuba. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.